Hello, I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, Vatican Radio. Pope Francis was elected a month ago now, and as the days go by, we're getting to know his ways, and the style of his pontificate is slowly emerging. One of his major appointments took place last Sunday, when, as we know, the 266th Bishop of Rome took possession of his cathedral, the Archbasilica of St. John Lateran. And looking ahead, another important celebration is due on Sunday, at the last of the four major Roman basilicas to be visited by the Holy Father, St. Paul's, outside the walls. In an effort to find out more about this visit and about the basilica itself and its significance, my colleague and friend, Linda Bordoni, went round to speak to the abbot there. He's Benedictine Edmund Power. Stay tuned.
Pope Francis, the very day after his election, popped into St. Mary Major. Then he was installed in St. Peter's. On the 7th, he took possession of his cathedral, St. John Lateran. And on Sunday, he's coming to St. Paul's outside the walls. Is there a meaning in this?
Coming to St. Paul's, I would say, is an essential part of becoming Bishop of Rome, because Peter and Paul are the patrons of Rome. They're the basis of the Church of Rome, of which he has been elected bishop. And so, I suppose, proclaiming his election in those two basilicas has a particular importance. The visit to St. Mary Major, I think, was essentially a personal or private visit, not a public taking of possession of that basilica, but an expression of gratitude in the light of his obviously strong devotion to the Blessed Virgin. And St. Mary Major is the first church of the Blessed Virgin in Rome. The Lateran he has to do, because the Lateran is the cathedral of the Bishop of Rome, so clearly he has to take possession of the Lateran Basilica. The visit to St. Paul's has not been billed as a taking possession, but I suppose more as a recognition of the importance of Paul. In Rome, the four major basilicas are called papal basilicas. Some people say collectively they form the cathedral or cathedrals of the Bishop of Rome, and they represent different aspects of the Roman Church and of the papal ministry. And so coming to St. Paul's, although it's the last visit of the four, although the Mary Major, I'm sure he'll celebrate a Mass there at some point, it's an essential part because it recognises that Paul is equally important to Peter. That the Church has never said Peter and then, oh, there's Paul, by the way. It's always Peter and Paul, Peter and Paul. And I think, you know, those two dimensions of the Roman Church are very important. So we're greatly looking forward to welcoming him and to celebrating with him the Eucharist above the tomb of Paul.
You are the abbot of the monastery as well as of the basilica, if I'm not mistaken. You're a Benedictine, and Francis is a Jesuit. How do you view the nomination of a Jesuit as Pope, and what are your hopes for this ministry of his?
Well, I sort of see the Jesuits as little brothers, really, in the sense that we Benedictines, maybe with a little bit of historical arrogance, sort of say, well, we've been around for 1,500 years, the Jesuits only 500. They're much, much younger than we are. But no, I'm jesting. In fact, there is a connection. There's a very interesting connection between St. Paul's outside the walls and the Jesuits. And I hope that Pope Francis will, I'm sure he will, recognize this when he comes. It was in the 1530s, if I'm not mistaken, that Ignatius of Loyola, who was making the pilgrimage of the seven churches around Rome with his first companions, stopped here because St. Paul's is one of the seven, and he actually made his religious profession in the Basilica of St. Paul's outside the walls, in front of a mosaic icon of the Blessed Virgin, which we still preserve in the Chapel of the Blessed Sacrament here, and it's known by the Jesuit name Regina Societatis, in other words, the Queen of the Society of Jesus. And Jesuits come and venerate this icon. There's a stone on the wall of that chapel put there by the Abbotton community to recognise the fact that this occurred. So the Benedictines who are here, we kind of feel that we gave hospitality to Ignatius at that moment, that important moment in his journey. In fact, having a pope who is a religious, who lives the consecrated life, which is, let's remember, a sign of the fullness of the kingdom. It's a difficult life, but it's a great charism, a prophetic charism within the church. We've not had a religious as pope since Gregory the 16th in the first half of the 19th century, and he was a Benedictine, Camaldolese monk. Since then, there's been no religious until now. And so it's a great honour for us, and I'm sure all people who live the consecrated life welcome the fact that we have a religious as Bishop of Rome.
Now let's go back to St. Paul's. You were saying that it represents a very specific aspect of the Petrine ministry.
Well, I'd say it's the Pauline ministry rather than the Petrine ministry, but the two, the Petrine and the Pauline ministries, find their union in Rome and maybe more directly, personally, in the figure of the Bishop of Rome. It's true that the Pope is normally described as Vicar of Peter, successor of the Prince of the Apostles, successor of the one who is the rock, and therefore the point of unity and stability of the Church, the one commissioned by Jesus to be the leader. And that's all essential and important. But we mustn't forget that before the Gospels were written, in fact, the first books of the New Testament are the letters of Paul, and it's his missionary dynamic, really, that started the theology of the church really growing. And his experience was rather different. He didn't know the earthly Jesus. He discovered the crucified and risen Lord, first on the road to Damascus, and then in the years that followed in his ministry. And what we see in Paul is a constant movement. He was never bishop of anywhere. He's associated with places all over the world, all over the Roman world, even Spain. There's a tradition that he went there. But Peter is more directly linked. He was first in the East, obviously, in Antioch and so on, but then in Rome. Well, Paul went everywhere. And so Paul represents not a stable, rock-like point of unity, but a dynamic, moving point. In other words, Paul, always on the move, is the symbol of the missionary dynamism of Christ's church. The Pope can't just sit comfortably in his great Basilica of St. Peter's and preside solemn liturgies. In the recent pontificates, we see how the popes, beginning maybe with Paul VI, but very strongly in the life of John Paul II, for example, all these trips around the world, because the missionary dynamic is so fundamentally important. It needs the dynamic of stability, the rock, but it can't remain just there on the rock. And therefore, Paul is equally important to Peter as the basis of the Pope's ministry. So it's a Petro-Pauline ministry, I would say.
very fascinating figure, Paul, but a fascinating basilica you have as well. You were saying the Mass will be celebrated, the Eucharist will be celebrated above the tomb of Paul. There's also another wonderful relic in your church, if I'm not mistaken, the chain.
Yes, the chain is a wonderful relic. At first sight, people see this chain of nine links hanging there in front of the papal altar and think, what on earth is that? Is this Catholic superstition? You can almost see Protestants shuddering at the thought of this. But I've always thought that even if we can't with 100% certainty say, yes, this is the chain that held Paul in his Roman imprisonment 2,000 years ago, if you really reflect on what it might symbolise, you realise how eloquent it is at the spiritual level for various reasons. One is that Paul speaks about his chains several times in the course of the letters, sometimes physically as a physical object or symbol of his imprisonment, which we know he had to endure, but sometimes as a symbol of the suffering in love that he willingly undertook to be identified with Christ in his passion, death, and resurrection. Sometimes as something that binds people together in their common faith and love. And so the chain has a number of different aspects to it, all of which are important. What I find, because I always have to give a little homily on it, is how easy it is to preach about the chains of St. Paul and the symbolism of this, a profound theological symbolism that touches the very core of our faith in Christ, in his passion, death, and resurrection.
St. Paul's Outside the Walls is the great meeting point between East and West, isn't it? Or it's the ecumenical basilica par excellence. It's outside the walls.
Yes, that's certainly true. I've often thought and spoken on the theme of, let's call it, the topography of Rome, the actual layout of the city and its major basilicas, and the symbolism of their geographical positions. And we've got St. Peter's that dominates Rome in every sense. Its enormity, it's visible from the Alban Hills, 15 miles out of Rome. You see the Dome of St. Peter's or from the airport. It dominates the city. It's the biggest building in Rome. St. Paul's nobody can see until you're quite close to it. Therefore, you see a sort of difference here. You see St. Paul's outside the walls, not really within the city, and not sharing, therefore, in a certain sense, that protective security of being within the walls. But I think that's part of the dynamism of the Pauline missionary spirit. You know, you can't remain within your walls. You can't just protect yourself. Maybe it's a day and an age in which the church has to go out in the Pauline spirit. It has to risk maybe leaving the protection of the walls to reach the great majority of humanity that doesn't share that protection. And so our basilica, which is dedicated to ecumenism, partly I think because Peter, great saint though he is, has been taken a little bit by the papal theology and, dare I say, triumphalism in past centuries, the importance of Peter, but maybe it's a little threatening to people who don't share the Roman Catholic perspective. But for them, maybe, Paul is more accessible because he's not within the walls, he's on the fringe and he's always in movement and he's always among the Gentiles. And so the Basilica has been declared by the popes, in fact, as the normal place for ecumenical welcome. And the monks, who've been here for 1,300 years, in fact, have in recent years had this confirmed by the popes that part of their role, guarding the memory of Paul, welcoming all pilgrims who come here, is to be open also to others who are not of the Roman Catholic faith, but who see in Paul an inspiration and a guide in understanding better the crucified and risen Lord.
question. It sounds like the kind of place that Pope Francis may be particularly comfortable in, for what you have been saying.
Clearly, I would imagine that all the symbolism of St. Paul will be very dear to his Jesuit heart, and that he will respond very strongly to what St. Paul's outside the walls means. And I hope he will recognise in us Benedictines fellow religious, certainly, linked to the Jesuit history, certainly. And I don't know, I would imagine we'll be quite prominent in the celebration. After all, this Basilica of St. Paul's, unlike the other three, St. Peter's, St. Mary Major and the Lateran Basilica, has no chapter of canons like the other basilicas and like nearly all cathedrals in the world. It has a chapter of monks. In other words, instead of a secular chapter, which is a group of canons, and in the case of the other Roman basilicas headed by a cardinal archpriest, this basilica has a regular chapter of monks headed by an abbot. We actually have an archpriest as well who has a direct responsibility for the basilica but has no connection with the chapter of the basilica. So we monks, as chapter of the basilica, I hope will have an important position in the welcoming of our bishop. I've not actually seen the new pope yet, except on television, of course. And so that moment when he alights from his car at the angle of the quadriportico of the basilica will be a very significant moment. I'm looking forward to the moment in which I shake hands with him or kiss his ring or whatever one does, and speak to him for the first time. But having many Jesuit friends, I imagine that there'll be an instant kind of understanding, because with other religious, there is something, even though we come from different religious traditions, with other religious, there's always a certain familiarity, or there's a certain understanding on the spiritual level, which is difficult to say exactly what it is, but it's always there, so I'm looking forward to that spark. I hope there'll be a nice spark when I meet him.
And you were listening there to the Abbot of St. Paul's Outside the Walls, Benedictine Edmund Power, who was speaking there to Linda Bordoni. My thanks go to both of them. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick.